Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Women Leading the Way Radio Show, where each time you'll hear from successful women CEOs, executives, and professionals, where we'll discover how they do what they do to be successful in business. We'll be interviewing women who have overcome big challenges, women who have incredible stories of lessons learned in dealing with adversity. We'll even interview women who have started and grown successful organizations and women who are C-level executives with unique talents and positions. Our goal is to bring successful businesswomen together to share how they're leading the way in business today.
Well, hello. Happy Monday, the 1st of June. I'm Cecile, and I am your host for Serving Up Diversity. And today we have a wonderful topic. It's called Legal Counsel's Role When the Employees Request ADA Accommodations, Americans with Disabilities Act. And I have a wonderful guest that I'm going to introduce to you in just a moment. But, you know, in today's workplace, it seems more employees are coming forward requesting ADA accommodations and indicating that they have a disability. And actually, ADA was created back in the early 90s as part of the Bush administration. And there are times when employers are unsure on how to handle the requests, when to say yes to an employee requesting accommodation, when to say no, or when to contact legal counsel for help. And our guest today is going to be discussing ADA and what employers must know in order to accommodate requests. So I'd like you all to meet Rosanna Ortega. She's president and business attorney of Ortega Business Law Firm, APC, and she's an expert in this area. So welcome, Rosanna. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Cecile. It's nice to be with you.
Well, we've got a number of questions. This is a topic and it that really is important to employees, and it seems that there's more and more focus being placed on employees with disabilities. And my first question to you is, are there any specific policies or procedures that employers must follow when trying to accommodate an employee with a disability?
Well, there are several, actually. Yes, the employer has to consider both federal and state law. So while we are focusing today more on the ADA, as California employers have to focus also on the Fair Employment and Housing Act, which covers employers with five or more employees, for complaints involving mental disability, physical disability, and medical condition. But it also covers employees with one or more employees for complaints involving harassment based on mental or physical disability. So the employer not only has to focus on ADA, which of course covers employers with 15 or more employees, but also on FEHA, which is the California law. And it's kind of a multi-focused issue, because you not only have to, as an employer, focus on the complaints regarding the disability and trying to accommodate the disability, but you have to ensure that you follow the procedures effectively and properly so that there is no complaint or claim or basis for such complaint or claim by the employee when it comes to the physical disability. You're also going to, as an employer, I think, always have in mind, if you're a larger employer and have 50 or more employees, you're going to also want to think about and know about the FMLA, which is, of course, Family Medical Leave Act, and also the CFRA in California, which is the California Family Rights Act, both of which focus on larger employers $1,000 with 50 or more part-time or full-time employees. And the reason I'm mentioning the CFR and the FMLA is because they are leaves, and when, as we'll probably talk about a little later, leaves are considered a reasonable accommodation by courts. So those are also important factors. Now, the employer will also, I mean, this is just a very sort of a logical area, as everything should be with law, but it really requires the employer to do a lot of assessment. And when you talk about policies and procedures, it is very important for the employer to follow its own, to have its own procedures and to follow its own procedures, because this is all about dotting the I's and crossing the T's. The employer will also look into what type of employer it is, she is, he is, or it is, because the CFRA, for example, excludes religious associations or nonprofit corporations. So, again, it's just a very, in a bit tenuous, but it is a very procedure-oriented issue.
Yeah, that's interesting. When you talk to us now, there's a couple things that are quite interesting. You talked that CFRA will not consider religious
associations.
Is there a reason for that?
Well, I don't know what the reason is. You know, you probably have to look at the legislation.
Yeah, that's the first time I've heard
that. Right. But, nonprofit corporations and religious associations are always sort of different, because they are, although they're businesses, they are not for profit. So they, you can seek exemptions, tax exemptions, for example, for those organizations. Nonetheless,
like
I actually represent nonprofits and sit on nonprofit boards, and I'm always, my advice to my clients is always, and to those boards on whose organizations I sit on, is always to follow follow procedure and follow guidelines, follow the law in California and the federal law if it applies, as much as you can, and sort of act cautiously, because these issues can be very volatile, especially issues of disability can be very volatile. They're very amorphous issues. It is difficult sometimes to determine what a disability is. If the person is disabled, you have to, you're dealing with privacy issues as well, because there are medical conditions involved many times, most of the time. My advice is always just to act, err on the side of caution. The CFRA is just a sort of an ancillary issue that we're talking about today, because it is a leave issue. So it doesn't mean that FEHA and the ADA do not apply to religious associations or nonprofit organizations. In fact, nonprofit religious organizations are covered by the ADA as employers.
Right, good. And you mentioned a little bit earlier, too, about sexual harassment. And I think you said something that you only need 5 employees, as far as that goes, that would fall under ADA around sexual harassment because of the mental side. Did I repeat that correctly?
No, actually, California employers with 1 or more employees have to follow FEHA, which is the Fair Employment and Housing Act, for complaints, involving harassment based on mental or physical disability. So many times what I hear, not necessarily in my practice, because I represent small to medium to larger employees, but what I hear out and about is that, I only have 1 employee, I don't have to worry about this. You do have to worry about it. And quite honestly, rule of thumb should be, if any time that you have an employee, you should have policies and procedures in place. and I'll talk about that in a second, but procedures are policies and procedures, personnel manuals, employee handbooks, which everybody hears about, those are really important, and they're honestly your first line of defense against any kind of discrimination claim, cause of action, based on harassment, disability, gender, sex, whatever the case may be. So it is very important for employers, as soon as you become an employer and have one employee, to institute some kind of policy and to start becoming acquainted with these laws, because you don't have to know every nuance of the law, every piece of legislation, but you do have to become acquainted with these laws. For example, under FEHA, an important aspect of complying with California law is what is required by it. So when it comes to applicants and employees with disability, the FEHA generally just requires two things. One is that employers have to provide reasonable accommodation for the applicants or employees who, because of the disability, cannot perform the essential functions of their job. And number two is that employers have to engage in a timely, good faith, interactive process with the applicants. And I cannot emphasize enough how important number two is, that engagement with the applicant or the employee is absolutely critical, because their state law incorporates guidelines developed by the EEOC, which is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And California court holdings and rulings have shown us, and California follows the EEOC guidelines very closely. So and they can be just small accommodations. Sometimes they don't have to be protracted or very costly or very involved accommodations. Right. But the guidelines do tell us that the employer has to consult with the individual, the employee or the applicant, to ascertain the precise limitations and how they can be overcome. So if you don't engage in the process with the employee, and I always tell my clients, just think about you sitting across the table from someone just trying to obtain information, being aware of their privacy rights, but just trying to obtain non-private information from them to determine how it is you can help. So again, before the employer even engages with the employee, they need to have some understanding of the law, and they need to understand what constitutes a disability in order to obtain the information that they need.
And that brings up another question when you're talking about the policies and procedures. And you're correct, obviously, and I've done them myself, that many times there's an employer who needs an employee handbook and they want to look at what policies and procedures. Do you suggest that, say, in an employee handbook, that employers should make some kind of policy about ADA, so that the employee knows that they can come forward? Because a lot of employees don't know what to do when they find out they have a disability.
Right. Well, I think, in answer to your question, I think ADA is important if it applies to that employer. There are certain employers that are just small enough where they know, and I'm a corporate attorney as well, so I know when I sit table with a client and we form a corporation or some kind of business entity, one of the questions that I ask is, do you intend to have employees in the future, not just for formation purposes, but also for obtaining the employer identification number, because the IRS will ask that question.
Correct.
And it is part of a business plan of an employer, a potential employer, when they come in and form their company or start their business or engage in a partnership with their partners, whether they will have short-term or long-term, whether they will have employees. So a lot of these companies know that they will probably have 15 or more, or have less than 15. So if they know that they will have 15 or more employees, I think the ADA should be an essential, or at least a component of their personnel policies.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps they don't have to state it succinctly. They don't have to put every nuance of the ADA, but they can provide information that will then inform the employee whether the ADA is applicable or not. And the employee can always go to the employer, whether it's the administrator, HR administrator, or their immediate supervisor, to ask about these issues. But quite honestly, mm-hmm. Cecile, California is more stringent than the ADA. Although with the ADA Amendments Act that took place in 2008, mm-hmm. The ADA actually is broader now in this particular
yep.
arena. So I hope I answered your question, but I think the...
Yes, you did.
Yeah, so I think it's very important, again, to understand, for the employer to understand disability, the definition of disability under the state law of that employee, and to understand the ADA as well.
And I think it's also important, too, and I know when I've been called in to, be the person who's going to ask the questions because somebody's filed a request, is you've got to have some kind of a format, because just mm-hmm. saying, oh, so you can't do this and that, we'll do what we can. But there should mm-hmm. be something that's very, very structured. Now, should that employer make up their own, or is there a way for them to get it? Obviously, they could talk to legal counsel for that, but if they don't have anything and they're saying, I'm not even going to talk to legal counsel, what should they do?
Well, I think that's a great question, and I think it's the the question of the moment, right? The question of the century, let's call it, because it definitely goes back even to your business plan. And I represent a lot of startups, so my sort of counseling and education piece always contains systemization and procedure. There is nothing more important to a company, in my opinion, than having systems in place so that that company can be successful. So whether it is in the financial arena, the tax, the business, or when it comes to HR issues, it's all the same. You've got to have systems in place. For disability issues or any kind of employment issues, systems are absolutely critical. So in answer to your question, I think it is very important for the employer's policies, for example, to set forth some kind of internal organizational chart that will inform the employee who to contact, if the employee has a disability, if the employee wants to leave, if he or she believes that he or she needs an accommodation, because believe me, and when you have, I represent employers, but I'm sure you'll have employment litigation attorneys who are on the plaintiff side who represent employees, and mm-hmm. I have a lot of colleagues and friends who do, and inevitably those employees are very savvy. They are doing a lot of research, and with the internet, anybody can research
yep.
anything. So
I know.
when they come to the employer, they've already done their research, and the employer cannot be behind the eight ball and act defensively rather than offensively. So what you want to try and do here is have a happy, sustainable, viable relationship with your employees, because then everybody's
yeah.
happy. And I always tell my client there are three things that make a business successful: employees, employees, employees. There are three things that make it unsuccessful: employees, employees, employees.
Yeah.
So it is very important yeah. to have that sort of internal structure. And it's for, in addition to the reasons I stated, it's in the process of determining a reasonable accommodation, the employer has to engage, as I stated, in that interactive process. Well, the first step in doing so is determining, for example, the essential functions of the employee's position. So
yeah.
that's typically determined by whom? That's determined by the either manager or the employer. Because when you, and you go back to systems, when you start thinking about having employees, you're going to think about what vacant positions do I need to fill, or what positions have now become available that I need to fill. So what are the, what's the job description for that? And so that's going to be part of your interactive process. And then also, the interactive process has to be conducted in good faith. And federal courts have stated that good faith essentially means that an employer and employee communicate directly with each other to determine essential information, and that neither party delays or interferes in the process.
Right.
So if you have those systems in place, that's going to be a great first step. You know, it's going to be a lot easier to sort of dot the I's and cross the T's than if you didn't have them. In small companies, for example, the requests are typically handled by the immediate supervisor or boss. If you have one or two employees, well, that's going to be really easy. Mm-hmm. I mean, the employee is just going to come to you. As far as forms, I always think it's a – well, I mean, every attorney is a great believer and advocate of documenting everything, right? But certainly I and you and I have worked on this before, Cecile, you know, putting, when we talk about systemization, just putting those forms in place. And I think that can be done with legal counsel and sort of, again, you know, acting from the, coming from the offensive, getting legal counsel to sort of structure something for you, some template that you can then use with every employee.
Yeah, I agree. And you know what, when you were talking about essential functions, which has to do, of course, with the job description, it's always interesting to me that employers don't typically specify what are the essential functions. They just throw everything into the job description. And you know, as we all know, everything can't be an essential function.
Right.
And even sometimes they even include that with the other duties as assigned. And so there has to be some specificity there to protect themselves as well as that employee, that what really are the essential functions.
Mm-hmm.
And can that person do it with or without accommodation?
Right. And that you bring up a great point, because there have been a number of times in my career where I have actually sat with new clients who, unfortunately, you know, they, a lot of times I get called in once the matter has progressed to a very, shall we say, pernicious stage. And so it's harder than to sort of go back and rectify some of these issues. But when I say, well, what are the essential functions, they actually don't know. So I think it's so important. In fact, one of the things I recommend is when you type up that job description and offer letter, attach the job description to the offer letter, because both of you have to be on the same page. You know, when you're in law school, they teach you about meeting of the minds, and that's like one of those catchphrases. So that's it. That's the meeting of the minds right there, or an example of it. You want that employee, and you want the employer, and you want the manager, and you want the supervisor. Everybody has to be on the same page as to what everybody is doing. And so if you find there are certain, especially for key executives, I work with a lot of, you know, key employees.
Mm-hmm.
So those executives, you know, they walk in thinking, well, I know what my job is. Do you really know what your job is? So whether it's the janitor, it's the executive, or it's the, you know, paralegal, or it's whoever it is, you're a team. You're a member of a team in order to make your company successful. So everybody has to be on the same page. So if you're thinking ahead, you know, my children always say I live 3 years into the future. Well, you have to think ahead. And if this happens, what are the consequences and how do I deal with those consequences? And I think that's an essential function of running a business.
Mm-hmm.
What are my different potholes and how do I rectify them before they happen? Not rectify, but how do I prepare for them? And this is
prepare
one of the ways you're going to prepare for it, because inevitably, if you're going to have employees, somebody's going to get sick. Somebody's going to be disabled because we're human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really true. And, you know, it's interesting because when you talk about, you know, and often the question is who's going to be the one to interview this employee. And sometimes employees are very hesitant if it's their supervisor and all. So my question is it ever appropriate for the employer to ask, like you, to come in and do that engagement, handle and get all the questions, answer all the questions?
Do you mean that's part of, like, the interview process?
That interview process, yes.
Okay. I don't think it's necessary, but I do recommend employers at least confer with legal counsel on these issues.
Yes.
Because sometimes they can be pretty complex. And I have dealt with issues for my the employers that I represent where we will go literally back and forth, and they will call me. It's like a soap opera. They will call me and then say, now this happened and now that happened. How does that fit into the plan that we'd established before, literally 2 days ago? So these issues can be pretty complex. They also are multi-elemental. I think that's the word I just made up, because they involve privacy issues, HIPAA issues. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are and again, you're dealing sometimes with laws that run concurrently. You're dealing with federal and state laws. I represent, for example, in national employers, sometimes international employers, sometimes regional employers. So we have to think about, where's our headquarters? What law do we follow?
Exactly.
All these kinds of issues.
And, you know, and I hate to interrupt you because we're getting down to our last couple of minutes and all. But you know what? I mean, you've answered so many questions, but we're going to have to do this again and talk about some other things because there's so much involved in all of these areas. Particularly around ADA and what's going to work for employers and employees together. And sometimes it's really tough, and we didn't even get a chance to talk about how to verify that they have these issues dealing with their medical professionals.
Right.
But we'll have to do that on another show.
Okay.
But I really appreciate you being a part of this, and I know you explained a lot, and our listeners, I know you have gotten a lot of information about this. So may I quickly, if I can do that, give them your phone number if they wanted
to
talk to you.
Of
it's 1-858-794-0098, and that's Rosanna Ortega of Ortega Business Law Firm. Thank you all for joining us today, and thank you so much, Rosanna, for all your information.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
Women Leading the Way is produced by Connected Women of Influence, the premier private membership organization where like-focused, business-to-business executive and professional women connect, collaborate, and cultivate a vast network of high-level affiliations, resources, and professional relationships. For more information about Connected Women of Influence, please visit our website at connectedwomenofinfluence.com.